Joining me now is Susan Coppedge, Ambassador at Large with the United States Department of State. She's the head of the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much.
Before that, she was an assistant United States attorney in Georgia's Northern District here in Atlanta. There's been a long time narrative. You know, Atlanta is one of the hubs of the United States and globally for human trafficking. Do you have some understanding of how big an issue Atlanta particularly has?
Yeah, certainly all major metropolitan cities in the U.S. have a human trafficking problem. And I think one of the reasons Atlanta got early publicity is that we were doing something about it. We were one of the first federal cases in the country to look at sex trafficking of juveniles that was occurring out on Metropolitan Parkway. And the community really galvanized around this issue. And so there was a lot being demanded from law enforcement, and there was a lot being done by law enforcement to address that. I know we have a lot of good research and resources in the state that are working on the problem, trying to quantify it, but we also have a lot of good programs at combating it.
Do you have a sense then of how effective, you know, use of funds that have been leveraged towards this problem in Atlanta have been?
And that's actually where we haven't had a lot of studies to see what happens with the money that's spent. And it's certainly something that the federal government is looking at to make sure that the programs that we're funding in foreign countries are accountable and are achieving results. And that is it's a hard area. It's hard to quantify it because it is a hidden crime.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about what you do now. So political leaders, including some of the ones who ran your confirmation hearing in the Senate, characterized the United States as the global leader on the issue of combating human trafficking, meaning the world looks to this country as an example of how to handle the range of issues that fall under that umbrella. That's a lot of power.
Well, it's a great opportunity to go out and speak on behalf of the U.S. government to foreign governments. And I think one of the reasons the U.S. is considered a leader is that we were one of the first to enact a law fighting trafficking. That was in 2000 with the Trafficking Victim Protection Act.
And a major component of what you're doing now with the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons is compiling the annual Trafficking in Persons Report, which is a kind of scoreboard or a ranking for how well the United States feels that other countries are doing in combating human trafficking. Is that right?
It's been called actually scorecard diplomacy. Every year this report comes out and it talks about areas where countries can improve their efforts and whether they're meeting the minimum standards to combat trafficking.
Talk about those standards. So what kind of standards do we use to decide the rankings?
Well, we look across three areas. We look at the efforts for prosecution. So we look at their laws. Do their laws comply with the UN protocol on what's best for trafficking in persons? Are their penalties stringent enough? And then we look to see if they're enforcing those laws. How many prosecutions and investigations do they have? We also look at victim services. What are they doing to assist victims? Are they funding government shelters? Are they allowing victims of trafficking who may face retribution if they go back to their home country to stay in the country? Those are things that we look at. And the last area is prevention. What are they doing to educate their public about trafficking and prevent it from happening in the first place?
What do best practices in prevention look like from your point of view?
So best practices can be if you've got a community that's particularly vulnerable to trafficking or an industry such as the electronics industry or the seafood industry where your citizens are going to work, telling them about the dangers of recruitment practices or not being able to hold your own travel documents. For example, many Filipinos work outside the country of the Philippines, and their government has taken efforts to say, before they leave the Philippines to work, let us know if you run into problems while you're employed overseas, and we will track the recruiters here in the Philippines that sent you into positions of vulnerability to trafficking.
So what happens when countries don't score so well?
Well, we hope that they want to do well for their own citizens. We hope that they want to do well for their own people. But we've also found that there's also some competition among regions in the world. And so, for example, you don't want to fall too far below what other Central American countries are doing or what other Middle Eastern countries are doing. So it's really helpful, too, because there's some peer pressure involved in the report that we think makes it more effective.
Do you guys also have sanctioning powers, ultimately? Tell me how that ends up working.
Right. So if you're on Tier 3, which means you are not complying with the minimum standards to fight trafficking, there can be sanctions imposed. some countries may have experienced a natural disaster or have political turmoil. And so those sanctions can be waived by the president for human rights or defense purposes. But the sanctions do come into play if you're on Tier 3.
Here in the United States, we have a lot of numbers that you hear thrown around, like $9 billion trafficking industry, 300,000 children in the U.S. at risk of trafficking, these sorts of things. A lot of those numbers have been looked at by journalistic organizations and found to be wanting. Here's a quote from a Washington Post article. There is no reliable estimate for the business of human trafficking in the United States. Your job is about trying to gather these kinds of numbers.
Well, we're looking more at what countries are doing to fight trafficking, and certainly those numbers can be indicative of how large the problem is in a particular country. We can look at the labor supply and what's happening with workers and whether their rights are being respected or whether they're being forced into working, for example, in mines or cotton fields or palm oil plantations. We can look at what's happening and see industries that are vulnerable to that. But you are right. This is a hidden crime. It is very hard to quantify, and it is happening, and it is very hard to get numbers on that. I don't think we can say, well, we can't measure it, so we shouldn't fight it.
How important do you think, though, that accuracy is in characterizing the sorts of problems that fall under the umbrella of trafficking? Because, of course, higher numbers get people's attention, and they get them on board for the cause. But if they're not accurate, you know, does that matter?
Well, higher numbers drive a lot of our funding decisions. What countries we put money in are the countries that have larger problems with trafficking, but also countries that have the political will to do something about it. So I think the numbers drive the funding and certainly drive the discussion, but I think what people care about are the individual stories they hear and wanting to help the individuals that they encounter.
Let's talk a little bit about language. Modern day slavery, that is a phrase that's increasingly used to describe a really large range of activities, much like trafficking. They almost, I don't know if you use them interchangeably.
I do use them interchangeably. Trafficking in persons, modern day slavery, human trafficking, all address the same problem. So certainly sex trafficking and labor trafficking, domestic servitude, which is nannies or maids working in someone's home, bonded labor, which is where someone has a contract and has you indebted based on that debt you owe, and child soldiering come under the U.S. definition of human trafficking.
Okay. So a lot of activists who use the word slavery or modern slavery to describe all these things would say that term is such a visceral one, and it's helpful to try to get people's attention to things that might otherwise be overlooked by the general population. There's another different strain of activism that says, from a public health perspective or a labor perspective, that putting all those issues into one bucket under slavery, under trafficking, can tend to encourage policies that don't successfully target the root of one of those things, but sort of missing the trees for the forest, essentially. Where do you fall in that conversation? I mean, how important is the use of the word slavery and separating things out or not?
So when I used to talk to juries and I would try to describe what is happening, it is slavery. Slavery is the inability to choose what you're doing to earn a living. It's somebody else compelling you to work or provide services. So they don't have the freedom to choose. They don't have the freedom to get up and leave the mine they're working in or the brothel where they're being held. So to me, it is slavery.
Maybe it's time to talk about New Zealand a little bit. You spent 6 months in New Zealand on a Fulbright to look at their laws on human trafficking. Is that right?
That's right. I was down there working in the Ministry of Justice.
And New Zealand, of course, decriminalized prostitution in 2003. In your conversations at the time talking to people engaged in sex trades, what did you learn there?
Well, one thing I did find is they were much more willing to tell law enforcement if there were underage girls working in the industry, because they knew they wouldn't be penalized themselves. And so it was a very maternal network, and they would tell law enforcement if there were juveniles there. It was just a different regime than the U.S. government follows. U.S. government policy now is that prostitution is dehumanizing to both men and women and can be a precursor to trafficking. Certainly, trafficking can hide within the commercial sex industry.
Last year, Amnesty International, I'm sure you know this, faced a lot of criticism from groups that call for the abolition of sex trafficking for officially adopting a policy recommending the decriminalization of consensual sex work. What are your thoughts on commercial sex, period, from all the experience that you've had, seeing how it works in different countries, seeing how it works here in the United States?
Well, it's certainly one of those areas where there's a debate going on and where different organizations feel differently about the topic. And I think one thing the U.S. government is good at is working with organizations that may have different philosophies on a variety of issues, but all want the same goal, and that is to protect those who are juveniles and those who are compelled by force, fraud, or coercion to work in the industry.
I want to ask a little bit about how being from Georgia and working in Atlanta has impacted the way that you take this message out to the rest of the world.
Well, it certainly helped that I had been a practitioner in this area. So when I get up to D.C., I'm not just a policy person. I actually have practical experience that I can share with the governments I'm traveling to. It also made it pretty easy to handle Senator Menendez from New Jersey, who was bowled over by my Southern accent and told me that he expected that I would be strong under my genteel demeanor.
Do you feel like people respond to you differently because of your accent or where you're from?
Well, I think people can hear the message more easily when it's not given in a kind of a superior or an intellectual perspective, but I can tell them from experience that I think makes the difference. Being somebody who knows the problems in investigating these cases, where victims don't always come forward to talk about their crime, and understanding that police will say, well, I interviewed her and she didn't tell me she was a sex trafficking victim, and saying they're not going to tell you because they're intimidated and they're afraid, and we had these same problems, and let me tell you about the investigative techniques we use to overcome that.
There are a lot of stories about significant bad experiences with law enforcement and the justice system. How do you manage those barriers?
Well, we try to show them that the law enforcement they're encountering now is different. And you can understand why people from another country where law enforcement may be corrupt or may be part of the problem or may be complicit in the trafficking or at least in the violation of human rights come here and believe their traffickers when their traffickers tell them you can't trust U.S. law enforcement. So we try to show them that they're not in trouble for violating U.S. immigration laws, for example, or they're not going to be prosecuted for prostitution crimes. That's one message that I feel strongly about and that I'm carrying to the countries I visit, is that we need to not criminalize victims of trafficking who commit crimes as a direct result of their victimization.
There's another perspective in the academic and legal world that says that, you know, even punishing Johns, people who purchase the sex, can have an effect of pushing the entire industry further underground, which makes it more dangerous for people engaged in sex trades.
Well, certainly the U.S. policy is to look at the demand as contributing to sex trafficking, and it's one of those minimum standards I talked about as being in the annual trafficking in persons report that my office puts out. So we do look at whether they're addressing demand, and certainly one way to address a demand is to penalize the purchasers of the illegal activity. We also look, though, at reducing demand for forced labor goods, and that's where we talk about educating consumers to know what they're buying and what they're purchasing, and to look back in their supply chain and see if the fish you're eating or the cat food you're feeding your pet have tainted slave labor in the manufacturing of those products.
We started out by talking about how the United States feels it's a leader in fighting trafficking and how your position is really about sort of leveraging that power in the rest of the world. In the past year alone, you know, we've read reports of salon workers being abused. We eat shrimp and feed it to our pets that's being processed by people who have absolutely no control over their labor. Mm-hmm. Countless stories of these labor violations. What's your view on how well the United States manages its own trafficking problems in relationship to trafficking? And how does that inform how you communicate the State Department's goals on these issues to other people?
Right. So certainly we want to lead by example. It's easier to go into a country and say, this is what we're doing. It's working for us. You know, would it work in your system? And one of the things I do talk about that we have done, President Obama issued an executive order looking back at the federal procurement practices to make sure, I mean, think what a big customer the federal government is and what a big purchaser. And so we look back at our procurement and make sure that the goods and services we're purchasing don't have forced labor in their supply chain. And it's interesting, though, it's not just government, it's consumers and businesses that can make a difference, too. And this is an area where the government must be in partnership with businesses to encourage them to look as well.
Ambassador at Large Susan Coppedge with the United States Department of State. She's the head of the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. Thanks for joining us, Susan.
Thank you for having me.